This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
I'm very excited to introduce Colin Dickey. He's here for the paperback release of his book, Ghostland. This is not, obviously, his first foray into strange and unusual things. He's written two books. And he also has short essays in The New Republic, Laugham's Quarterly, and he contributes to LA Review of Books. How many of we here on Thursday for Caitlin Doughty? Okay, well, Colin is also a member of the Order of the Good Death, which is a collective of sort of creative types and people who deal with death professionally. And they're trying to change the way we think about death and deal with it. If you don't know who they are, look them up because they do some really, really good work. I picked up Ghostland last year when it came out in hardcover, thinking, oh, well, that sounds cool. What I didn't expect it to be hit me quite as hard on sort of an emotional level, because it was as much about the living as it was about the dead. And Colin is really, really good at sort of adding layers of social and historical commentary to think about why we make ghost stories, how we make those ghost myths, and what that says about our mindset, our history, and sort of who we are. And I'm not going to say much more about it. I'm just going to say pick up a copy. And it's also a beautiful book, which you can use as a Halloween decoration right now. So please join me in welcoming Colin Dickey.
Thanks everybody for coming out, and thanks for Politics and Prose for hosting me. This is, I think, your fourth or fifth event today. You really packed it in today, so thanks for bearing with me. I didn't actually, you'd mentioned Friday the 13th, I didn't actually prepare anything, so I can't give you the full story, but y'all should look into the history of Friday the 13th. For many years, the number 13 was superstitious, and Friday was superstitious, but the two were finally combined in a 1906 viral marketing campaign, which, again, I'm doing from memory, so double check the year. But this guy who had a sort of kind of pump and dump stock market scheme that then wrote a book to tie into it. And in order to drive up book sales, he created this whole myth around Friday the 13th. So that's actually why Friday the 13th became a thing. So that's a fun thing, but that's not what we're here to talk about tonight. But I'll talk maybe just sort of generally for about 10 minutes, and then I'll read a little bit from the book, and then we can chit chat and take turns sitting in the haunted chair. The first I did want to talk, this isn't in the book, but I want to talk about why we're here now in October. Because I think this is just one of those cool things that we don't tend to think too much about. But I, of course, want to talk about ghosts and haunted stuff all year round. But for most of American culture, October is the month. And this is a thing that has not always been the case. And I was just thinking today about how relevant this is, that in the first half of the 19th century, the holiday that is associated with telling ghost stories and haunted stuff is, of course, Christmas Eve, right? It is not Halloween. And in fact, of course, if you think about the most famous Christmas story that we have is, of course, a ghost story. It's Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, right? And conversely, the most famous ghost story we have is A Christmas Story, right? You know, that for many years, Christmas Eve was when we gathered as a culture and we sort of gathered around the fireplace and told ghost stories. And I'm just going to read a couple paragraphs from this humorist, Jerome K. Jerome, who put together a collection of ghost stories in the 1880s and talks a little bit about Christmas Eve that I just love this. So, why on Christmas Eve, of all nights in the year, I could never myself understand. It is invariably one of the most dismal nights to be out in, cold, muddy, and wet. And besides, at Christmas time, everybody has quite enough to put up with in the way of a house full of living relations without wanting the ghosts of any dead ones mooning about the place. There must be something ghostly in the air of Christmas, something about the close, muggy atmosphere that draws up the ghosts, like the dampness of the summer rains that brings out frogs and snails. But whenever five or six English-speaking people meet round a fire on Christmas Eve, they start telling each other ghost stories. Nothing satisfies us on Christmas Eve but to hear each other tell authentic anecdotes about specters. It is a genial, festive season, and we love to muse upon graves and dead bodies and murders and blood. So that's Jerome K. Jerome. So how we get to Halloween and October is through, and some of you probably know this, through Irish and Scottish immigrants. That starting in the second half of the 19th century, they bring All Hallows Eve, you know, Halloween, which is sort of an amalgamation of a Catholic holiday and the Celtic holiday of Samhain. And so it really comes to us through the Irish and the Scottish. And so you see advertisements in like 1860s and like in Philadelphia for advertisements for Halloween, where you can hear like a cultural event where you can hear dreamy tales of old Ireland, right? You know, this idea that Halloween is when you would hear kind of folk tales and tales of fairies and goblins from sort of Celtic areas like Scotland and Ireland. And one of the things that's really fascinating is that sort of Scottish immigrant associations and, you know, cultural associations, by the end of the 19th century, they're trying to divest Halloween from its sort of superstitious roots, and they want to make it kind of like St. Patrick's Day. They want to sort of, like, they're trying to sort of force it into this idea that it'll, like, Halloween would just be a kind of Scottish cultural holiday where we would sort of celebrate Scottish culture. And what I find really fascinating is the way that sort of, like, backfires, that what we don't lose the superstitious aspect of Halloween, we lose the cultural specificity, right? You know, that sort of non-Celtic based immigrants, or the rest of Americans start to say, well, you know, we don't want this holiday as a commemoration of Ireland and Scotland. We want it sort of for ourselves. And so it becomes sort of a universal sort of spooky holiday. And so I just, you know, every Halloween, I think again about our current discourse about immigrant culture and assimilation, and, you know, and without, obviously without minimizing the discrimination that, you know, Muslim Americans or, you know, Mexican immigrants are facing right now. It's sort of the history of Halloween suggests pretty strongly that 100 years from now, Americans are going to be celebrating Dia de los Muertos and Eid Mubarak, and probably talking about the commercialization of Eid Mubarak, and we'll think nothing of it. You know, so I think of Halloween as a time that, you know, is sort of representative of the way in which we have successfully sort of integrated an immigrant culture into, like, the fabric of America, and how that's pretty cool. So anyway, so that's the why, that's the when. Right. That's why we're talking about this now. But as I said, this book can be enjoyed year round. Please, please don't restrict yourself to the next couple of weeks. It's a great stocking stuffer. Great on St. Patrick's Day, 4th of July holiday. So just a little bit of background about this book. This began for me. I grew up in San Jose, California. So anybody here know the Winchester Mystery House, which is a couple of people? Yeah. So I grew up sort of down the street from the Winchester Mystery House, which is often described as the most haunted house in America. And the story that you get on the tour is that Sarah Winchester, I guess there's a movie coming out with Helen Mirren in February about her. Sarah Winchester was the daughter-in-law of the guy who founded the Winchester Rifle Company and sort of became fabulously rich. But her husband and child both died. Her child died in infancy. Her husband died a few years later of tuberculosis. And so at some point after that, she moved from New Haven, Connecticut, out to San Jose, California. She bought this farm room, this eight-room farmhouse, and over the next 37 years turned it into this sprawling 161-room Victorian labyrinth. And again, if you've taken the tour, it takes about 2 hours to walk through the house. You walk over a mile without stepping outside. And you only go through about 110 rooms. It's a really bizarre and amazing house. And the story that you get on the tour is that she became convinced that her family was cursed by anyone who had ever been killed by a Winchester rifle, and that she was building the house as a labyrinth to keep the spirits at bay. So originally I thought, oh, I'll just write a story about that. That sounds cool. And as I did the research, I found that a lot of that that last little bit I told you, the sort of reason for the house, is actually not, doesn't track well in the actual historical record. The historical record suggests something quite different, and that this idea of a woman living alone, being haunted by the spirits of people who had been killed by the Winchester rifle, the gun that won the West, was in fact more of an invention and a projection. I started to think about the way in which that story, while maybe not historically accurate, reflects a lot of sort of fundamental myths and stories about America that have been sort of brought together in this figure, this one woman. You know, the idea of a woman who lives alone, who never remarries, and the sort of discomfort that our, you know, sort of male-oriented culture has about women living alone, has about women who are not sort of pegged to, you know, husband, father, children, whatever, you know, that her very presence as a spinster sort of creates unease, and people sort of look for explanations for that. The story of this gun that was sort of instrumental in the sort of displacement and genocide of Native American cultures, and the sort of way in which Sarah Winchester has come to be the kind of collective mourner for that, you know, that she sort of exists for some people to sort of bear the burden of that historical stain that, like, most of us white people just sort of take for granted. And so she sort of becomes this figure, and that house becomes this way for all of these sort of folk tales to express a lot of the anxieties that you know, different kinds of Americans have about our culture. And that's what really sort of drove the book, is this idea that what I wanted to do is I wanted to look at these ghost stories less with the question of, do I personally believe that ghosts do or do not exist, which is kind of a, like, there's no way to win that conversation. You know, there's nothing you can tell a believer that will disabuse them of the notion that ghosts exist, and there's nothing you can tell a skeptic that will prove to them that ghosts exist. So I'm just going to sidestep that entirely. But rather, what are the stories that we tell about ghosts, and what are the buildings that we see as haunted? What do those then tell us about ourselves, I guess, is one way to put it. So that's kind of how the book became and what it is today, and what you'll all walk out of here tonight holding in your hand for the low price of $17 plus tax. So that's the main thing. And I tried to go around the country. I tried to visit different kinds of places. I went to haunted hotels, I went to haunted prisons, haunted insane asylums. I went to a haunted brothel, not as a customer. I tried to sort of see as many different places and gather up as many stories and sort of throughout the country. I did not make it to DC, unfortunately. So I have for you tonight no stories of haunted DC, which I am kind of bummed about. But I've got a close second in Richmond, Virginia. So what I'm going to read is from the chapter on Richmond, Virginia. And I'm not going to be able to read the whole thing because then we'll be here all night. So I'll just kind of move around a little bit, and hopefully, if I have done my due diligence, it will still make sense and be sort of interesting. So this is about Richmond, Virginia. Hopefully it'll be about 10 minutes. We'll see. Oh, let's have some water first. That's the ticket. There are ghosts everywhere in the historic Shaco Bottom neighborhood of Richmond, Virginia. The upscale restaurant Julep's is thought to be haunted by the ghost of a gunsmith's apprentice named Daniel DeNoon. His boss shot DeNoon over a disagreement while he was climbing the stairs. The staircase his body fell down was later converted into a storage closet, but employees report hearing the thump of a body falling down the stairs from time to time. Tiki Bob's Cantina, a bar on 18th Street, is now closed, but in its heyday it was home to bikini contests, jello wrestling, and the spirit of a knife-wielding fishmonger. At the ornate Main Street train station, workmen and security guards have heard footsteps through the empty halls late at night. Next door, Rosie Connolly's pub is haunted by several ghosts. One, a woman in period dress who vanishes when confronted, and another, a man often seen in the kitchen, and one whose past is similarly unknown. Over on East Carey Street, the building standing between 14th and 15th Streets is supposedly built on the site of a brothel that dates back to the early 1800s. On its upper floors, spectral women clad in gauzy dresses wander. Staff are known to hear their names called, only to turn and find no one there. It's hard to find a building in Chaco Bottom that doesn't have a ghost story attached to it. Local historian and paranormal investigator Pamela Kinney speculates that this is because Virginia was home to the earliest settlements in North America. Which makes sense, so long as we all agree that by settlements, we really mean settlements of Europeans. Which is to say, the kinds of ghosts you look for and the kinds of ghosts you see depend on your frame of reference. For when I began to tally the supernatural records of the area at the heart of Richmond, a simple fact emerged. The ghosts of Chaco Bottom are overwhelmingly white. This is curious because if you walk just a little way away from the haunted bars and shops down by the freeway, you'll find the Devil's Half Acre. For decades, black men, women, and children were brought here, imprisoned and tortured while they waited to be sold to planters and speculators. Dozens of slave traders had offices here where slave auctions were widely advertised, and men came from all over the South to make their fortunes on the backs of those enslaved. Tens of thousands of men's and women's lives changed hands here in the years leading up to the Civil War. All the activity centered on Wall Street in the heart of Chaco Bottom. Today, Wall Street is gone, replaced by the freeway, but the rest of the area remains mostly unchanged. While it's difficult to estimate how many people lost their lives in the slave pens of Chaco Bottom, hundreds of sets of human remains have been found in this nearby slave burial ground. We typically think of ghost stories in terms of the remnants of a terrible tragedy, a past we cannot escape, a justice unavenged, like Hamlet's father. Why then, in a place that should be haunted by the legacy of such a terrible injustice, the scene of countless deaths, should there be nothing but white ghosts? For once you start looking for ghosts that aren't white, they're easy to find. Maybe not in Chaco Bottom itself, but as Baby Suggs tells Seth and Toni Morrison's Beloved, not a house in the country that ain't packed to its rafters with some dead Negro's grief. In the 1930s, workers under the Works Progress Administration began collecting stories of former slaves, everything from recollections of their day-to-day lives under slavery to questions about clothing, medicine, and firsthand accounts of slave auctions and mistreatment. The stories were compiled in 17 states from Indiana to Florida and accelerated with urgency once it became clear that these firsthand accounts were quickly disappearing. For more than two-thirds of the respondents were in their 80s when they were interviewed between 1936 and 38. By the 20th century, America's understanding of the history of slavery had become tinged with nostalgia via folklore involving contented slaves and benevolent owners that emphasized agrarian life typified by Joel Chandler Harris's Uncle Remus folktales, which became the basis later for Disney's Song of the South. The slave narratives collected by the WPA, on the other hand, sought a more neutral approach. Allowed to speak in their own voices, those interviewed as part of this project offered a largely untold version of the antebellum landscape. Interviewers were given a list of questions to ask, and one of them, number 13, asked specifically about ghosts. Could the respondent remember the songs and stories of their childhood? Had she learned any stories about raw head and bloody bones or any other haunts? Had he personally seen any ghosts? Answers to the question vary. Some interview subjects didn't believe. Some knew rumors of ghosts were just whites intimidating them. Some spoke of ghosts as terrifying things, as comforting things, as exhausting things. Jane Arrington of North Carolina told one WPA worker the story of John May, a slave who had been beaten to death by two white men named Bill Stone and Oliver May. After his death, she reported, John May came back and worried both of them. He kept them awake, hollering and groaning all through the night, hounding them relentlessly. According to Arrington, it got so bad that other slaves became afraid of the white men because of the ghost of John worried them so bad. Another respondent, George Bollinger, spoke of a haunted Benton Hill in Missouri, telling the interviewer, one night we was driving through there and we heard something that sounded like a woman just screaming. Old man Ousbury was with me and he wanted to stop and see what it was, but I said, no, you don't. Drive on. You don't know what that might be. In these stories, ghosts terrify, but embedded in the terror are cautionary tales. A woman named Florida Clayton recalled how, as a child, she and her peers would often see a covered wagon that would appear in Tallahassee where she lived, always in some secluded spot. While the kids might have been tempted to approach this mysterious wagon and investigate it, they were told by adults that inside was dry head and bloody bones, a ghost who didn't like children. Only as an adult did Clayton learn that the wagon was in fact owned by a slave hunter, who would steal children and take them to Georgia to be sold, and that her parents and other adults had invented the dry head and bloody bones ghost as a means of protecting them. A man named Thomas Lewis of Indiana once described a place where there is a high fence that was haunted. He says, "If someone gets near, he can hear the cries of spirits of black people who were beaten to death. It is kept secret so that people won't find it out. Such places are always fenced to keep them secret." He then recounted a story. Two men were out hunting, and their dog began chasing something, running through the fence after it. As one of the men started to follow, his friend said, "What are you going to do?" The other replied, "I want to see what that dog chased back in there." His friend told him, "You better stay out of there. That place is haunted by spirits of black people who were beaten to death." Isabel Daniel of Missouri recalled one haunted tobacco factory that no slave would go near after nightfall. "When the nights were still and the moon was full," she reported, "you could hear the ting, ting, ting of the lever all night long and voices of the slaves crying out and complaining, and you knew there wasn't anybody there at all, just haunts." Again and again, these ghost stories revolve around a tenuous and threatened connection to the past. Ghosts will emerge at times through the breakdown of family. One woman in Tennessee saw the ghost of a woman appear before her while she was giving birth. Not recognizing the apparition, she called out, "Who are you?" The ghost replied, "Don't forget the old folks," and then vanished. That was when the young woman realized it was the ghost of her own mother. A man identified only as Uncle Lewis spoke of ghosts in terms closer to melancholy than fear. Ghosts, he claimed, are sociable, and they want to stay near living people. "When folks get scared, it hurts the haunt's feelings, and they go somewhere else," he said. If slave owners and traders sought, in a very real way, to obliterate memory and history for those they enslaved, then melancholic ghosts like the ones Uncle Lewis saw may themselves be in search of their own pasts. Folklore always bleeds and blurs, and it would be overly reductive to state a hard and fast distinction between ghost stories told by whites and those told by the black community. There are, of course, stories of black ghosts that serve the same function as white ghosts, marking a location, explaining the unexplainable, commemorating an event. But what is clear is that history is not just written by the victors, it's written by the literate. The prohibition against enslaved Americans learning to read or write had the immediate purpose of denying them agency and keeping them under control. But in the long run, it also meant that the stories, lives, and opinions of millions of Americans were lost to time. Ghost stories theoretically should be an antidote to this, based on oral tradition and handed down through the years. Outside the purview of acceptable history, such folklore should, and often does, act as an alternative history, a record of the oppressed and forcibly illiterate and the marginalized. But Shaco Bottom's ghosts show that this isn't always the case, that precisely because ghost sightings are so ephemeral and so vague, they can easily be attached to the dominant narrative and to only that narrative. Once one of the main economic engines of the South, Shaco Bottom now feels hollowed out, devoid of life and real commerce. Far from the universities, it doesn't attract much in the way of a nightlife feel, though not for lack of trying. There are half a dozen bars, Thai food, buy-the-slice pizza, a couple of vape shops, a few nightclubs. So it's not to say that there haven't been attempts to revitalize the area. For years, the mayor of Richmond had pushed a plan to build a new stadium for the city's minor league baseball team, the Squirrels, downtown on land adjacent to the Devil's Half Acre. Meant to draw new life into a faltering part of town, the plan succeeded mainly in drawing ire from preservationists and those worried that such a massive construction project would obliterate valuable archaeological traces of the city's past. After the project was announced, an archaeological team, largely funded by Richmond Slave Trail Commission, set out to uncover the Devil's Half Acre once and for all. Through a careful study of old maps, they located the area where the complex once stood, some of it partially obscured beneath the freeway. In December 2008, excavation work through the damp and muddy ground by the James River Institute for Archaeology unearthed the remnants of the jail. And while the team didn't find the expected implements of torture, such as whipping rings or iron chains, what it did find were unexpected hints of lives that were lived there, bits of tableware, English china, earthenware, the remnants of a porcelain doll. How does a city balance commerce with remembrance? The ghost stories that are told about Shaco Bottom are not only harmless, they add a festive patina to the city's bars and restaurants. an air of mystery and glamour. They invite you to spend an evening with an ephemeral time just out of reach, to add a small bit of wonder to an otherwise average night out. What they don't do is speak to a past whose legacy can still traumatize. They don't ask the patrons of Richmond's nightlife to consider a complicated history, and they don't ask the city's white citizens and tourists to face difficult facts. For those who would rather not revisit those days, the city's ghost lore makes it easy, turning our attention to murdered gunsmiths and fabled prostitutes. But that's not to say that there aren't other ghosts present. Dolores McQuinn, chairwoman of the Richmond Slave Trail Commission, recalled, "I started weeping and I couldn't stop when those bits of china and porcelain doll were discovered. There was a presence here. I felt a bond. It's a heaviness that I felt over and over again." So I'll stop there. But if you want to ask questions or tell ghost stories or sit in the chair or see if we can levitate books across the room.
You mentioned Halloween at the beginning of and how it grew in this country. How does it stack up? Why can you have any in your research? Why hasn't Valpurgis not taken off here the same way? Since everyone looks the, I mean, when they start selling Halloween stuff in August,
right?
You would think they'd look for another holiday like that.
Well, you think, yeah, you think they would. Although, you know, as I was saying before, Christmas used to also double as that holiday, and once Halloween became ubiquitous, Christmas sort of ceased to be a ghost-telling holiday, you know, and it came to be about Santa and presents and stuff like that. So I sometimes wonder, I don't know that I have a hard and fast answer for you because it's maybe, you know, hard to say for sure, but I sometimes wonder is as much as we need like one holiday about ghosts and goblins that, you know, we as a culture, at least the mainstream non-weirdos, only want one, you know, they only need one, that, you know, that there's not that same sort of need for a bunch of different holidays, that Halloween has sort of like sopped up all that feeling into one area. I guess that's the short answer, or the even shorter answer would be, I don't know, Hallmark, like it's a weird thing, but yeah, it's odd the way that some things will sort of catch on and then become sort of kind of cultural juggernauts.
Well, does it seem like maybe, and I'm just winging it here, that maybe Valpurgis Knot is too dangerous, too close? I mean, and maybe Anton LaVey had something to do with that?
Could be. I mean, you know, has anybody here seen Meet Me in St. Louis, the Judy Garland film that my grandmother would make us watch all the time? Because you guys know my grandmother. If you remember, it's from the 1940s, but it's set in 1904, and there's a great scene in Halloween where Trudy, the little girl, she has to go murder somebody, you know, and like murdering somebody means showing up at the door of your neighbor, knocking on the door, and when they open, you say, "I hate you, Mrs. Johnson," and you throw flour in their face, and then you're like, "I've murdered Mrs. Johnson." So like the actual sort of cultural rituals do change through time. I mean, we didn't always just like have candy, although I think we had candy as early as like the 1890s. So it does sort of evolve through the years, I guess. So,
what is your favorite ghost story that did not make it into the book?
One of the stories that I really liked that I really wish I could have gotten in the book is actually a haunted drive-in in Honolulu, Hawaii. Which has been subsequently torn down. The story of the haunted drive-in in Hawaii, I also wanted to just be able to like go to Hawaii on my publisher's dime, right? But the story is that there was a bathroom in this drive-in, the women's bathroom, where you would go in and there would be a woman who was washing her hands at the sink, right? With long, long black hair. And then at some point she would turn around to face you and she had like no face, right? It was just like white, just like pure skin, right? So that was the Hawaiian drive-in bathroom ghost. And if you know anything about Japanese culture and Miyazaki films, if you've seen Spirited Away, you know that that's actually a very common ghost in Japan. The no-face ghost is something that's like a long-standing part of Japanese tradition. And that makes a lot of sense for Hawaii because so much of Hawaii's culture comes from Japan and Asia. So it would make sense that of all the places in the United States that would have a singularly Japanese ghost, it would be in this place that sort of straddle, you know, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, that sort of straddles the U.S. and Asia. And so I love that story because it's such a clear reflection of the way that ghosts, ghost stories tend to be sort of culturally specific, that in Japan this would be a very normal ghost, whereas in the United States you don't find it anywhere except in Hawaii. So that's, I just kind of ran out of time and space and money, so that one didn't get in the book, but I kind of wish it was, so.
You mentioned that you traveled across the country looking for ghost-related areas. Is there an area that surprised you with how large of a ghost culture there was in terms of understanding the local history?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of my default assumptions, and I think the assumption that a lot of us make, is that the older a city, the more ghosts it's going to have, right? That Boston's going to have a lot of ghosts, that New Orleans is going to have a lot of ghosts. And that's true, they do. But then maybe Phoenix won't have as many ghosts. Las Vegas won't have as many ghosts. LA won't have, you know, just by virtue of the fact that they've been settled more recently, right? But this turns out not to be true, you know. And one of the things, I actually lived in LA for 14 years, so I didn't have to travel there, thankfully. I like sort of knew, I knew a bunch of the ghost hunters in LA. I knew a lot of the locations. But I love how rich a place like LA is with ghosts, even though it's, you know, a quarter as old as, you know, Richmond or New Orleans or something like that. And I do think that really does speak to the way, and again, in LA, you're not going to find Wild West ghosts and brothel ghosts and stuff like that. You're going to find, you know, Hollywood starlets. You're going to find Rudolph Valentino. You're going to find Marilyn Monroe. And so the ghost stories that a city will tell about itself really do become an integral part of how that city tells its own history. So that, you know, whereas, you know, in Vegas, of course, all the ghosts are in casinos, you know, that again, it's like, it's very much about the architecture of the casino, which is unique to Vegas, and thus Vegas sort of creates a very different category of ghosts than LA's ghosts or, you know, New York's ghosts or something like that. So that's kind of what I found on that score.
I know you just talked about Japan, but this is such a unique concept. Like, I've never really read or actually thought about culture in terms of ghost stories. Have you ever put any thought into ghost stories outside of American culture, like anything from like Europe, Africa?
Yeah, and the thing that you should do is get a lot of people to call my editor and tell her that they need to fund a worldwide travel and like probably 3 or 4 books, because I don't think I could. No, I mean, in some ways, I'm joking, but it is, you know, at some point I just had to like cut it off, or else this would just be an endless project, right? So the United States was one way of being able to say, this is how I'm going to narrow this down. And also, so much of this is cultural, so much of this is about the folklore that you grow up with, that the ghosts of the United States felt very natural to me. Whereas, you know, with Japanese ghosts, I know something about it because I've studied it and I've researched it, but it would be a different approach because it would be clearly an outsider. And so I would love to. It's just ran out of, you know, again, like ran out of space and stuff like that. So,
Colin, you spoke about the idea of culture and the differences. Do you find, besides being dead, do you find commonalities that emerge almost everywhere, or are they really kind of submerged under the regional differences?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely found commonalities. One of the themes of the book that wasn't really evident in the excerpt that I talked about was about architecture itself, you know, and why some buildings feel haunted and others don't, you know, and, you know, why do Victorian houses feel haunted, whereas, you know, like brutalist architecture doesn't feel haunted, you know. So, and so, like, one of the things I found was that there is a commonality in the way that certain buildings like work on us in a way. You know, I mentioned before the Winchester Mystery House, because it, you know, it feels like a labyrinth. It feels disorienting, you know. You have been in so many houses in your life. You know, you've been in thousands of houses. So you know when you walk into a house, you know where the kitchen is, even if you've never been there before, right? You know, right. You just, like, you know, we build houses in the same way, right? So when you walk into a house and the kitchen is in some weird place, right? You know, or the bathroom is sort of oddly spaced. Like, there, you know, you'll figure it out. But there's a moment where you're like, that's weird. You know, and again, I mean, in addition to my experiences in San Jose, one of the things that really fostered this book was when my wife and I were looking at a house in LA, and we kept looking at weirdly built small houses that had been just sort of oddly constructed. So you'd walk into the living room and there'd be the window out into the backyard, except there was another house or another room behind it. And you're like, well, why is, you know, like, why is there a window from one room to the next? And so I really got to think about the way in which unsettling architecture sort of tends to breed ghosts. And I think that's a commonality that I found throughout the country. And, you know, like whenever you're in a house that feels a little bit odd, the odds of there being, you know, ghost stories attached to it are pretty high.
Just a quick follow-up.
Yeah.
You dealt with a lot of communities in your book, which I had a chance to read in hardback, so I don't have to buy it tonight.
Thank you.
You're welcome. but I can't endorse it. It was good. No, the idea of it is, have you followed up anywhere? Has any particular site gotten back to you and said, man, from that book, we've increased? You know how, I mean, ghosts, I mean, it amazes me how much money there is in ghosts. I mean, every Washington has it, Sandria has it, this has it, and yours were, you know, very well done. So I just wondered if anybody had gotten back to you, you knew anything.
No, and if they did, I would ask for a cut.
That's what I was
hoping. Yeah, exactly.
Right. That was the whole idea.
That's probably why.
For giving you that idea, I was going to ask for a cut.
Oh, right, okay, yeah, yeah, so I get it. It's a multi-level marketing scheme. I get it, yeah.
Hello.
Hi.
I recently took a ghost tour of Georgetown, and they there was a big house there that made them mention the Winchester House. And you said that the research you did didn't really bear out the story behind the Winchester House that's told. What did you find as terms of what was the real story?
You know, I try and kind of keep that a little close to my vest so that people go out and buy the book. But I like you guys. You're a fun audience. You're hanging out. So the one of the really fascinating things about the Winchester story is when you talk to historians know a lot about rich people because rich people write letters, they keep diaries, they have stuff. The stuff gets passed down. It's nicely made. They have large houses. The houses get preserved. So rich people leave behind a legacy In a lot of cases, historians struggle with poor people because poor people are more ephemeral. They move around a lot. You know, they're maybe not literate. And so one of the really weird things about Sarah Winchester is that she was so fabulously rich, and yet we know much less about her than we like historians would expect for, you know, an upper class woman like that. We have some letters and we have some we have a lot of letters between her and her lawyer. We have some letters between her and her sister-in-law, which are really revelatory in terms of giving you a glimpse. But it's painful because there's just a couple, and you get so much in these letters. And you're like, only we had more. And I have my theories as to why we don't have more. But what we do know that she was not in any way crazy or you know, roaming around the house pathologically mourning, wearing black, weeping and wailing. We know that none of her employees, of which she had many, none of them ever in her lifetime sought to tell the world that she was crazy or beset by spirits or that she had seances. So we have no positive evidence of any of that. And considering the fact, when you think about the people who worked with her, if she was really doing all these seances and worried about ghosts, you have a pretty high feeling that would get out, right? Mm-hmm. What we do know is that she was not a professionally trained architect because women were not allowed to go to architecture school until like the 1890s. It was the earliest, you know, women were admitted into the L'École des Beaux-Arts. So we know she was a self-taught architect who, for me, like I see her as like many folk artists, you know, be they working in like needlepoint or woodworking, who just sort of take it upon themselves to develop a craft. I just see her craft as architecture. You know, I see that, you know, whereas some people make these elaborate quilts and they've never been to art school or whatever, but they just make these beautiful quilts in their spare time. She had the means to just play around with making a house, you know? And so the way she describes building the house is she'll say, you know, well, I had this hallway, and then I added this room on the side, and it blocked out all the skylights, and now the servants are tripping down the hallway because it's dark, so I gotta like redo that. You know, like, so there's a lot of her, she just sort of would like try something out, and then it would have all these unintended consequences that would then lead to other things. So that's kind of the best I can give. And I understand that it's extremely unsexy compared to like the haunted widow like chasing ghosts. But I also like the flip side of it is I think that's a really cool art practice that doesn't get recognized as such. If she's just sort of pathological and crazy and doing weird stuff, then the house is a manifestation of psychosis. Whereas if she is a self-taught artist, the house is a manifestation of her craft and her work. And I think that's a cooler story in some ways, even if it doesn't sell as many tickets.
It's still pretty interesting that someone would just perpetually keep trial and erroring on
right,
her house.
Right, exactly, yeah, so. Exactly, yeah. So.
Thanks so much for your talk tonight.
Yeah.
I was wondering a little bit about what you think the future of ghost stories looks like. So they're kind of, you have this old timey vibe and everything with technology, with more ways to verify things and facts and history and everything. What do you think the future looks like? Is it good? Is it bad?
Well, so I ended the book talking about a friend of mine whose father was a really influential early product manager of computers, right? He was sort of on the forefront of the mini computer revolution of the late 70s and early 80s. So he was a sort of technological kind of innovator. And his house, which he sort of built in the sort of early to mid 2000s, was an early example of what we are now referring to as the Internet of Things. So he had the light switches automated. He had, you know, they were all set up to sort of follow his rhythms and stuff like that. And he had this sort of elaborate computer system controlling temperature and the water and all this stuff. So after he died in, I think, 2010, his two daughters sort of inherited the house. And as you can imagine, the computer systems from like 2007 are already like obsolete, right? So the two women had difficulties like figuring out how to shut things off and how to turn things on, right? And the house continued to live in the rhythms of its departed owner, right? You know, so Tom West had taught himself to go to bed at 10, right? Because it was not good for his health if he stayed up late, even though he liked to stay up late. So at 10 o'clock, all the lights just go out. And the computer that controls the lights is buried in a wall behind drywall with no easy access. And it's written in a computer code that is totally bugged out and doesn't work. So now if you live in the house, you go to bed at 10. You know, like there's you know, like this is the problem that Jessamine and her sister had, is they just could not overcome the house's sort of inertia for its deceased occupant. So that's one of the ways in which I see the future of ghosts is running through the technological systems that are increasingly going to run our lives, that you know, that ghosts are a function of, in some ways, a sort of memory out of control, and that is very much how internet works. I mean, it's very, you know, it's how social media works. This happened to me. I don't think Facebook does this anymore, but I got a notification from Facebook asking me to reconnect with a friend who had died 8 months earlier, you know. But Facebook didn't understand that. She just hadn't, you know. Facebook was like, why is this person not interacting with our site? Let's get this person interacting with our site. And she died, you know. So like, so there's all these ways in which this idea of like memory out of control is going to sort of drive the future. And I think we're just going to continue to have ghosts that way. So
thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about why so many ghost stories and ghost lore have to do with mental hospitals. Is it the architecture again, or is it stigma about mental illness that's left over in our culture?
A little bit of both, but I was really interested in the architecture. So I was driving here. I've been driving cross country researching another book, and I was driving through West Virginia, and it was the middle of the night, and I'm like, I'm just gonna stop off at the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum, because who doesn't, right? So I roll in at 10 o'clock at night, the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum, expecting it to be all creepy and abandoned. And there's like 40 people there because there's like a midnight flashlight tour, which was even sort of creepier than had there been nobody there. So those asylums were built to be welcoming, and they sort of were meant to sort of look like a Victorian home. And because you paid to have your family member treated there, and you wanted to feel as though they were getting good treatment, right? And as those asylums decayed over the years, they got overcrowded, treatment methods changed. So much of that became about, you know, what used to be welcoming and fun became a representative of of aspects of how we treat mental health issues in ways that people don't want to function. So I guess that's maybe a kind of shorthand version of what I talked a lot about in this book, but it is really, you know, yeah, it is about the architecture. It's about the way those buildings were built and how our intentions get coded into architecture in a way that lasts much longer than the intentions themselves, that we change our attitudes and our cultural attitudes much faster than our buildings actually fall down. And so that's a legacy. Same thing with Victorian homes, same thing with old, you know, fortress-like prisons like Eastern State Penitentiary. It's like we change ideas and yet these buildings are left standing. And that, I think, is a lot of how they become like haunted.
Okay, you just answered part of my question because you focused on architecture.
Yeah.
So it means you did not do cemeteries.
Oh, I did do cemeteries. Yeah, yeah, I did. Okay. I did look at cemeteries. I spent some time in Stull, Kansas, which is a cemetery haunted by it's a mouth to hell, so they say, where the devil comes up twice a year, and the devil appears to take the form of many drunk college kids and empty beer cans. So the people of Stull, Kansas are busy exercising themselves of hooligans more so than actual paranormal events. So yeah, so I did.
Did you do the Gray Ghost?
I don't know that I'm familiar with that. What's the Gray Ghost?
Okay, in the beach community there. Okay, I'll tell you afterwards about the Gray
okay.
Ghost.
All right,
but it
awesome.
Really is
yeah.
a rich story. Yeah,
okay,
I'm surprised
cool.
you didn't.
I mean, I love it
ghost.
Already. I love the Gray Ghost. That's a great sort of
okay.
wonderfully evocative
okay,
name.
That so. Saved a family during the hurricane.
Oh, wow. Okay.
There. Okay.
Cool.
Which
cool.
Is
yeah.
Relevant.
Okay. Yeah. That's
how were you defining ghosts, you know, in terms of separating them from unsettled spirits from other dimensions?
Loosely, I was defining ghosts because, again, I was not interested in proving their existence or disproving their existence. And when I was interviewing ghost hunters in LA, I would ask them, you know, what they thought. And I got really, really varied explanations. You know, all these guys all believed in ghosts. They all had their meters and stuff. But what they claimed to be experiencing was wildly different. And the one that really struck me is this one guy who told me that they are wormholes, that they are, you know, like, so he's using sort of cutting edge, like, astrophysics to explain what's happening when you see a ghost is a temporary wormhole through time back to 1930 or whenever is momentarily opening where you're getting a glimpse of whatever. And it's not that I believe or disbelieve that, but what it made me sort of think about in terms of the book is that I didn't want to foreclose that possibility. I didn't want to verify it. I just wanted to say, what I'm referring to as ghosts are the just whatever anybody wants to call a ghost, you know, and however anybody wants to define it. Again, I was more interested in the stories that got told about it and the places that got associated than I was in a kind of ontological kind of understanding of the physical materiality or lack thereof. So that's how I just kind of tried to, because again, we'd be here all night, you know, if we were like decided we're going to prove or disprove ghosts once for all, like it's not going to happen. So this was a way of having that conversation without having to get into a loop of unanswerability.
Thank you. I'm actually just going to close out. I'm going to be the last person.
Yeah.
So that we're not here all night.
Okay. Politics and Prose burned down 30 years ago.
Well, it is actually haunted. So if you
cool.
Yeah. So if you do do something on DC, come back.
Okay, sure.
But you said so the most sort of haunted feeling you ever got, I think, was in the Mustang Ranch or something like that, where
yeah.
it was actually sort of tied to psychological, you know, experience.
Yeah.
And so my question is actually probably unanswerable. It's sort of a question of making of ghost stories and what ghosts do you think we're going to make, like, in this time? Like, where everything is topsy-turvy and we're all kind of...
Yeah, just some backstory for those of you who will be reading the book tomorrow. So I was sent by Maxim Magazine to profile the owner of the Mustang Ranch, which I feel is important to say that I was not there as a client. But it was so I was doing this completely other writing job when you know the women who worked there were like, oh, by the way, this place is totally haunted, right? But one of the things that they told me in a number of different ways, and I saw sort of firsthand, is that the job of working at a brothel, sex work, is emotionally and psychologically really taxing, which sort of makes sense once you know that is that you know I asked you know how much of your job is sort of emotional labor as opposed to physical labor, and they I said, is it 90%? And they said it's 100%. You know that, and so you know these women are working as basically in addition to everything else they do as untrained therapists, you know, and thus the psychological exhaustion is actually quite high, that it's a very difficult job for many people. They don't have a lot of turnover because I think they've gotten very good at sort of picking good people who will fit the job well, but they did describe at length how it's a very difficult job and it's not one for everybody. And so that's where I was like, oh, well, that would make sense that people would see ghosts as an expression of just like emotional and psychological exhaustion, right? You know, like it's like when you're vulnerable, when you are, you know, sort of strung out and sort of had, you know, a really tough time, that then you see something and you're sort of more likely, and kind of almost like a 19th century sort of hysteria kind of way, you'd be more likely to sort of see things that then got labeled ghosts. That was like my hypothesis. But that was also where the only place in all the places I went where somebody actually showed me videos of things like record. And I was like, well, that's odd that I'm looking at this video and I'm clearly not emotionally taxed from being involved in sex work. So, you know, so that's just the background for that question of, and so, yeah, so I guess to answer your question, partly is that I don't know that I believe that hypothesis, you know, at the end of it, that I don't necessarily, it didn't bear out that, you know, that people who were sort of at their most sort of extreme emotional were more likely to believe in or see ghosts than people who were more recharged. So, but as I was saying before, I mean, I think that one of the main drivers for ghost stories is really this idea of sort of memory out of control, you know. And when I think of this year, I think of how fast everything has happened and how quickly we have all been processing information and how many things which take just time to work through are just being filed away because we don't have time. You know, I mean, I was watching CNN today and a woman who had been in Vegas, had been at the concert in Vegas, had survived, flown back home to her house in Santa Rosa, which is now gone. You know, which has burned to the ground, you know, and the CNN anchor was like, have you processed this? And she was like, no, you know, like, right. Like, she's like, thankfully right now there's just things to do. You know, now I'm just like, I'm just trying to just do things and I'm not looking forward to that time when I actually have to process everything that's happened. And I think that's where the ghosts are going to come from. Hurricane Harvey and Hurricane Irma and Hurricane Maria and the Northern California fire, they're going to come from all these things that are like traumatic incidents that we as a culture just like haven't dealt with because there's no time, because it's already on to the next thing. And I think that's also the future of American ghosts, I think. So
thank you so much. And just give Colin a hand again. And thank you very much.
Yeah, and again, thanks everyone. I know it's a Saturday night. You could be out karaokeing. I could be out karaokeing. Thank you again for coming out.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.